Order, order.
What exactly are we using the House's time to do?
That question again, this time from Labor's Wigram MP, Megan Woods, just before the House adjourned on Thursday evening, interrupting its debate on the third and final reading of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement Amendment Bill, a debate that New Zealand First Leader Winston Peters tried to block.
I move that the order of the day for the third reading of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement Amendment Bill be discharged.
The question is that the motion be agreed to. Those of that opinion will say aye.
And they included National, ACT, United Future and the Māori Party, giving the government 63 votes against the opposition's 57, although that was to change with this request from the Māori Party's co-leader, Marama Fox.
Mr Speaker, we'd like to correct our vote. It's a requirement of our agreement that in cases of procedural motions, we must give notice to the government that we would vote against them. We've now done that, and so we would like to be able to correct our vote and support the motion to discharge the TPP.
While moving two votes across to the noes column, that didn't alter the decision to proceed with the debate, which included this contribution from the Greens' Gareth Hughes.
Sometimes words just can't convey the situation. All you can do, Mr Speaker, is face palm.
For older listeners, to face palm is when the palm of one's hand is brought to one's face as an expression of dismay. Now back to Gareth Hughes and the third reading of the TPPA bill.
Surely this is the definition of futility. The day after Trump's elected, Nationals passing the TPPA bill. You could not write this stuff, Mr Speaker. It encapsulates what a failure and a farce this entire seven-year process has been.
The Greens' Gareth Hughes, and strictly for reasons of balance, we cross the chamber to Nationals' David Bennett.
To the Green Party, the Green Party. When we look at the Green Party, don't want any trade agreements, no trade agreements in the Green Party. At least they are being honest about that.
Unlike some other parties across the chamber.
There is help coming for New Zealand First, and that is Gareth Morgan. He is the real Donald Trump of New Zealand, not Winston Peters. Mr Gareth Morgan will take your votes away. Mr Gareth Morgan is a true Donald Trump representative, not the pretender that is the New Zealand First leader that wishes he was Donald Trump but has never made any money in business, that has been 40 years as part of that political elite and will never be able to represent ordinary people because he represents the epitome of what has been talked about.
Nationals Hamilton East MP David Bennett. And now for younger listeners, an epiphany is a sudden insight into the real meaning of something. And Winston Peters had already had one of those in the debate following this motion from the most senior government minister in the debating chamber when the House resumed at 2 p.m. on Thursday.
The Honourable Stephen Joyce.
Mr Speaker, I move that the House convey its congratulations to President-elect Donald Trump on his election as the next President of the United States, and to Vice President-elect Mike Pence on his election, and doing so express our desire to work with the incoming Trump administration to continue building on New Zealand's already strong relationship with the United States.
Labor's Deputy Leader Annette King joined Mr Joyce in congratulating Donald Trump before moving right along.
I also want to acknowledge Hillary Clinton, who achieved much in her public life and has been a good friend to New Zealand.
Mrs King quoted Hillary Clinton's statements made earlier that morning.
They must accept the result and look to the future. She said they owe the new president an open mind and a chance to lead. And, Mr Speaker, we support those sentiments.
Unlike Greens co-leader Matiria Ture.
The ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in moments of comfort and convenience, but where he stands at times of challenge and controversy. These are the words of one of the truly great Americans, Martin Luther King. Yesterday's result in the US elections has left me and the Green Party even more determined than ever to fight for the values that we believe in. We have generations of families living in poverty, people who face uncertain futures without proper housing or health care or education, people who don't believe that being involved can make a difference. That is something that we can, that we must change. We must use the Trump election as a powerful motivator, a motivator to stay involved in the governance of our country and to include others in that process, to organise, to be strong, to listen to each other, to speak truth to power, to find hope, to be kind to each other, to be kind. So, no, I will not support this motion to congratulate Trump, and neither will the Green Party. We vow to fight the climate change denial, the misogyny, the racism represented by Trump. We will not let hate triumph. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Order,
Mr. Speaker.
The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
The New Zealand First Leader said Mr. Trump's victory had come as no surprise to him.
I predicted what so many experts did not. That was not after the event, not after the event, beforehand, who would win, who would become the 45th President of the United States. And that cacophony of embarrassment is not going to deter us today.
While the result may have confirmed Mr. Peters' prophetic powers, it must have been a surprise for the other Greens co-leader, James Shaw.
I don't think that Americans will choose Trump today.
James Shaw was speaking in Wednesday's general debate when Twitter was reporting the race in Texas as too close to call.
And I believe that is because Texans have got quite a good sense of when someone is talking a lot of hot air. One of my favourite sayings comes from Texas, Mr. Speaker. It refers to someone who is all hat and no cattle.
James Shaw in Wednesday's general debate, a few hours before the election result was declared, while Mr. Peters, speaking 24 hours later, had the benefit of both foresight and hindsight to muster his cattle into this epiphany, with its insight into Trump's supporters.
People who work hard, pay their taxes, and just want a fair go. We have three words for these people, as in America, as in the UK, but now New Zealand. One party uniquely has these three words. We hear you.
Yes. Mr. Speaker.
Marama Fox.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I had three words in mind, and they weren't those ones. I think they were pot, kettle and black.
Marama Fox also had an epiphany.
I'm a pragmatist at heart. I like to see the silver lining around the clouds. And as I look to America, I think, well, you know what? The bricklayers are going to be happy and the concrete merchants will be happy because they'll be building a wall very soon to keep Americans in.
The only other speaker, the ACT MP David Seymour, was also the most enthusiastic about a Trump presidency, although he did have one reservation.
And that is, I know that many women in the US and many women in New Zealand are deeply disturbed by the comments made by a man who has now been elected the leader of the free world and one of the most powerful men on the planet. And I certainly hope that on behalf of that sentiment, on behalf of those people that he has disturbed, he will back away from those comments and apologise. But with that minor quibble, I join with other leaders in celebration of democracy and in congratulation of the 45th President-elect of the United States, Donald Trump.
Mr. Seymour's doubts about Donald Trump's attitudes to women were unlikely to convince one woman just a few yards away across the chamber.
Do not come near me, Mr. Seymour, unless you're crossing the floor for a vote.
Tracy Martin, education spokeswoman for New Zealand First, was speaking in Wednesday night's first reading debate on a members' bill to abolish charter schools. More on that now from Rhys Lyon.
The Education Charter Schools Abolition Amendment Bill is in the name of Labour's Chris Hipkins, whose party colleague, Jenny Salesa, stood in for him last night as the bill neared the end of its first reading.
Charter schools has been a failed model. It is a failed model from overseas, and we see here in Aotearoa New Zealand they've also failed here to the point that we've actually closed a school down. There is a lack of accountability at charter schools, but they get bonus payments. In addition to the very generous base funding that they get, In 2015, four out of the five charter schools have received bonuses of over $60,000, despite only one of them meeting all of their contractual obligations. Mr. Speaker, this is something, as I say, the Labor Party will abolish. Charter schools are a thing of the past.
The bill was opposed by Māori Party co-leader Marama Fox.
I find it absolutely remarkable that we are even discussing the fact that our young people, Māori people specifically, cannot get an improved educational outcome by going to a charter school. Of course they do. And if we, if public schools could have done what charter schools are doing, or Māori medium schools are doing, then shucks, they'd all still be there. But they're not.
Meanwhile, New Zealand First's Tracy Martin supported the bill and directed her opposition to charter schools at one of the MPs who has championed them, ACT Party leader David Seymour.
Do not come near me, Mr. Seymour, unless you're crossing the floor for a vote. Then come on over. Come on over and see the error of your ways, Mr. Seymour. Vote on the side that knows education. Vote on the side that stands up for the education and the public system of New Zealand. Here is a young man who spent 6 months in a think tank and unfortunately it's gone to his head. And this government has allowed that party to dictate and waste New Zealand taxpayers' dollars on this system.
Back to the government benches and Nationals' Chris Bishop.
What is wrong with partnership schools? Innovation targeting underachievement.
Order, the member's time has expired.
Assistant Speaker Trevor Mallard calling an end to that speech from Chris Bishop. And while that bill was later defeated by 63 votes to 57, earlier in the evening, Mr. Bishop's compensation for live organ donors bill completed its committee stage. Also successful was the Papawai and Kaiko Kirikiri Trust's amendment bill, a private bill in the name of National MP Alistair Scott, who said the bill sought to update the Papawai and Kaikirikiri Trusts Act of 1943.
This bill removes the patronising attitude that is so prevalent in that act. So this sanctimony at the time, basically it was saying, sorry guys, you guys don't know what you're doing over in the Wairarapa. We here in the Māori Land Court and in the Ministry of Education, we know best. We know best what is good for you, and we will determine how this thing should be run. This bill allows Wairarapa Māori to determine their own future relating to the trust, the assets of this trust, for themselves.
Nationals' Alistair Scott, and that bill passed its final reading unopposed, while later in the night, Labor MP Ruth Dyson's Rates Rebate Retirement Village Residents Amendment Bill, which seeks to grant rates rebates to residents of retirement villages, passed its first reading unopposed and was sent to the Local Government and Environment Committee for public submissions.
And that committee also got back the Resource Management Legislation Bill. And another historic moment as the House grappled with an unprecedented event. A bill discharged after a select committee failed to report it back to the chamber on the due date, with the government then moving to send it back to the committee. It's the bill containing the government's controversial amendments to the Resource Management Act. Now back with the Local Government and Environment Committee, where it has already spent 11 months.
The Resource Legislation Amendment Bill had its first reading in December last year and was sent to the Local Government and Environment Committee, which was eventually granted two extensions to its report back date. That most recent due date was November the 7th, last Monday, and when the bill wasn't reported back in time, the government, after a lengthy wrangle in the chamber, moved to send it back to the committee. In question time yesterday, the minister in charge of the bill, Nationals Nick Smith, faced a series of questions on the proposed bill, including from Green MP Eugenie Sage.
Does he agree with former Prime Minister Sir Geoffrey Palmer that the Resource Legislation Amendment Bill contains at least three significant and dangerous trends, including greater ministerial control and centralised decision making, and reduced opportunities for public participation?
The minister said he agreed with Geoffrey Palmer that the bill made significant changes to the original act.
But his criticisms reflect his defensive view of his original RMA design that has proved to be excessively bureaucratic,
order,
litigious and costly. There is a fundamental shift from Sir Geoffrey's model in these reforms in having stronger national direction and consistency. This makes common sense because for a country of our size, having 86 different approaches and 80,000 pages of different rules and policies across New Zealand does not make sense.
Nick Smith also faced questions on the bill from Labor's environment spokeswoman, Megan Woods.
Why did he announce yesterday that he is going to seek the approval of Parliament to refer the Resource Legislation Amendment Bill back to Select Committee, given that so many councils, environmental groups, the Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment and the Law Society have criticised the bill?
Mr. Speaker.
The Minister insisted that the committee needed more time to consider a departmental report on the bill and accused opposition parties of blocking a move for a report back time extension.
It's inevitable with a bill of this size that it will require refinement at Select Committee. The committee only received the 500-page report last week, and I'm at loss why members opposite will not let the committee consider that report.
Though Eugenie Sage suggested it was the government who was at fault for not allowing the committee to release a report on the bill.
Why should New Zealanders believe that this government cares about hearing their views on anything when national members of the Select Committee wouldn't even allow the Select Committee to report back and wouldn't allow the members of the opposition to have their report back?
And Mr. Speaker,
the Honourable Dr. Nick Smith.
Mr. Speaker, the idea that the Select Committee would be able to report back on a bill when it received a 500-page report and only had one day's consideration, actually, it's members on this side of the House that is saying the bill should be referred back to the Select Committee so that they can do their job properly. It is our side of the House that's showing proper respect for those submissions.
That's a report from Rhys Lyon. Failure to report the bill back on time last Monday meant it went back on the order paper for a second reading without benefit of any amendments by the committee, which had received some 800 submissions on it. Now, after a lengthy wrangle on Thursday over how to deal with this unprecedented move, for which there are no established standing orders, the Speaker ruled that there would be no debate before the House decided to send the bill back to the committee with National supported by United Future and the Māori Party. Now, with more from the committee rooms, here's Rhys Lyon.
On Thursday, the Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee continued its hearing of submissions on the New Zealand Intelligence and Security Bill, which rewrites laws governing the country's spy agencies, and heard from the Clerk of the House of Representatives, David Wilson.
My focus in the submission is primarily on the provisions around the Intelligence and Security Committee, which we've had a long interest in because it carries out many of the functions that a parliamentary committee would otherwise carry out. And the bill before the committee proposes that the ISC, Intelligence and Security Committee, retain some features that are not associated with parliamentary committees, and those are really the issues I wanted to focus on. I guess out of concern that since this committee is doing a job that a parliamentary select committee would otherwise do, if it departs significantly from how those committees work, particularly around openness and accountability, then the wider perceptions of how Parliament operates could be affected. The first thing I wanted to just bring to the committee's attention, set out in clauses 50 to 89 of the bill, are the which provide for the intrusive powers for the intelligence agencies. And I really just wanted to highlight the fact that there's a 2010 memorandum of understanding between the Speaker, the SIS and the Minister responsible, which seeks to balance the House's privileges and its constitutional position with the SIS's ability to undertake its lawful duties. The Privileges Committee had a look at that MOU in 2014, and they highlighted an issue in it. So the MOU requires that the Speaker's briefed by the SIS on intelligence warrants that authorise the use of intrusive powers against members. But the Speaker doesn't have the power to decide whether or not a seizure or an interception should proceed. The Privileges Committee thought the Speaker should have that power and flagged that as an issue to be covered in the review of intelligence and security legislation. It wasn't dealt with in that review, so I just raise it with you now as something that your parliamentary colleagues considered a couple of years ago, thought ought to be provided for, and isn't to date. I'd also mention there's just some work going on in my office with the MOU with the SIS and also working on one with the GCSB around how those agencies would interact with Parliament. So then just to go on to the powers of the Intelligence and Security Committee or its functions, Clause 155 of the bill sets out the functions of the ISC and effectively it reenacts the relevant provisions out of the existing 1996 Act. What I'm proposing is, rather than setting out all of the functions of the committee in the new subsections A to D, simply replace them with one subsection that says that the committee has the functions conferred on it by the House. And then concurrent with that, I propose going to the Standing Orders Committee and asking it to recognise in Standing Orders the role of the Intelligence and Security Committee, which at the moment it does at the start of each Parliament through a sessional order. So rather than having to renew those and give the committee powers every 3 years, it would simply recognise it as having certain functions. That's how the powers of all other committees are set out. And I think that would be more consistent with the idea that the ISC is carrying out functions that a select committee otherwise would do. And it would also avoid detailing in legislation the powers and the roles of the House or one of its committees. We'll try and avoid that because it can be a bit problematic when the House changes its procedures, which it potentially does every 3 years. Legislation takes longer to change and is, you know, more complex and more time-consuming. There's a couple of examples. For example, the bill talks about the committee carrying out financial reviews. Select committees no longer carry out financial reviews, they carry out annual reviews. The subsection A in the bill at the moment talks about the functions of select committee, and the functions it sets out are those that select committees used to perform prior to 1996. And so those have changed significantly under MMP. And, I mean, it's easy enough to change those things, but I think it just is, it illustrates the problem with setting down in law something that actually changes a bit more frequently, which is parliamentary procedure. Clause 164 of the bill is a secrecy provision, and it includes an offence provision as well. It reenacts the current existing provisions, which talk about information given to the ISC being privileged. To my mind, that word is a bit confusing in that context. Privilege has a certain meaning within Parliament, which is different. It refers to the rights and powers of Parliament to go about its business, protecting those. Really what's being talked about here is secrecy, and I just suggest that perhaps secrecy be used rather than privilege in that context. But I think there's probably a bigger issue around that clause, which is the extent to which the offence provision in it can be effective in light of the operation of parliamentary privilege. So proceedings in Parliament can't be questioned or impeached in any court. Article 9 of the Bill of Rights 1688 tells us that, and so does the Parliamentary Privilege Act of 2014. This bill says that the proceedings of the committee are treated as being subject to parliamentary privilege, and that's in Schedule 3. So you couldn't, with all of those things operating, couldn't rely on those proceedings either to prosecute that offence or to defend yourself from a prosecution against it. So that's not to say there shouldn't be an offence, but I wonder whether it would be worth doing some more work on how that offence is expressed so that it doesn't rely on using proceedings in Parliament to be operable, because those proceedings can't be relied on for that sort of purpose. And I'd be very happy to make officials available to help the bill's officials work out a way of doing that. Just got two other quick points to make. At the moment, when the ISC carries out functions that a select committee might otherwise, looking at a bill or a petition, those records are released at the discretion of the ISC. In my view, because it's carrying out functions like a select committee, they should be released as a matter of course, but subject to grounds for withholding sensitive information on security grounds, which is not normally an issue that another select committee would need to think about. I think that would be consistent with parliamentary practice, which is to be open and to release information, and also public expectations around openness around parliamentary activity, but also acknowledging that because of the subject matter, there will be a different need for confidentiality around some intelligence and security materials than there might be in other situations. And the final thing I wanted to mention is Clause 134 of the bill talks about lodging complaints with the Inspector General. So this gets away from the role of the ISC a little bit, but the provision that's similar that's currently in force doesn't specify what the Speaker can complain to the intelligence to the Inspector General about, although it provides that he can complain. The proposed clause 134 says the Speaker can complain that the House has or may have been adversely affected by an intelligence and security agency. And I just question whether that restriction on what the Speaker can complain about is necessary. In my view, the Speaker is only likely to complain in the most serious of cases. And I think it's not desirable to reduce the scope of what those cases might be. There could be cases where the Speaker, elected by the House to speak on its behalf, thinks that there might be an undesirable effect on an individual MP rather than on the House, or on the duties MP might perform in their constituency or in some other setting that is not about the House's proceedings. And I just think it's not really necessary to limit the Speaker in that way when it's not a power that's been used a lot or I think would be likely to be overused if that restriction was removed. So those are a summary of just some of the points in the submission.
The Clerk of the House, David Wilson. The New Zealand Intelligence and Security Bill is due to be reported back from the Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee by February the 18th. Also this week, the Health Committee continued its inquiry into public attitudes towards euthanasia, splitting into three subcommittees on Monday in order to make a dent on the more than 1,600 oral submissions it's due to hear on Marion Street's petition on the issue. Meanwhile, also on Monday, the Primary Production Committee released its report on a petition signed by almost 63,000 people calling for a ban on rodeos in New Zealand. In the report, the majority of the committee said that new guidelines around rodeos were currently under consideration, with the committee encouraging the Rodeo Association to work towards better compliance with the Animal Welfare Code through self-monitoring at rodeos. The Green Party, meanwhile, provided a minority view, stating it's concerned that electric prods, rope burning, flank straps and calf roping are all permitted under the current Code of Welfare, leading to its recommendation that such devices and events should be prohibited. And finally, on Thursday, Reserve Bank Governor Graham Wheeler appeared before the Finance and Expenditure Committee to deliver it with an update on his announcement earlier that morning that the Reserve Bank had dropped the official cash rate, which sets the country's interest rates, by a quarter of a percentage point to 1.75%. In total, there were 18 committee meetings held during the week.
Rhys Lyon. Also this week, the House approved a recommendation from the Officers of Parliament Committee to appoint former Transport Secretary Martin Matthews as the new Auditor General. And we end, as usual, with a look at the week ahead with the Deputy Leader of the House.
The Honourable Simon Bridges.
Mr Speaker, when the House resumes on Tuesday the 15th of November, the Government will look to complete the first reading of the Maritime Transport Amendment Bill, the third reading of the Patents Trans-Tasman Patent Attorneys and Other Matters Amendment Bill, and to progress a number of other bills on the order paper.
The Deputy Leader of the House, Simon Bridges. I'm Tom Frewin, and this programme was made with funding from Parliament.